Jagna Podcast.
Greetings and welcome back to the Jagna Podcast. I am your host, Brandon Jones. And on today's episode, I had the opportunity, the honor to chop it up with a young lady who, man, I mean, super inspiring. By the name of Naya Williams. Naya is the author of the book Cotton. Definitely go pick up a copy of Cotton. But what makes Naya even more important than being an author is she's only 20 years old. I mean, this is what blew me away. She's 20 years old. She's born and raised in DC, currently an undergraduate at Harvard, and she's pursuing a career in medicine. But as a young person, she's pretty active on her campus and in other places. And one of the methods that she utilizes is poetry to push forward different levels of social change. Super dope young lady, very inspiring. I had the honor to chop it up with her on today's episode. I think that you will find it constructive. I did. And definitely, if you like the episode, you need to share this with other people. It's always good to hear about folks in general, but especially Black folks doing their thing, especially young Black folks. And we talk about that too. Her being 20, I didn't even know she was 20 till about halfway through the interview. I was like, wow. But that is the power and the genius that a lot of young people have. And it's important for us to continue to cultivate and nourish and encourage these young folks as they go through their journey, because this is just her first book. I'm pretty sure she's got tons more to go and other things to offer the world. So I'm gonna stop boasting. I'm gonna let you make your own determination on how dope Naya is. So sit back and enjoy this episode, and I'll see you on the other side. This is Naya Williams. All right, so Naya, can you tell us who you are, where you come from, and how did you get to this point in your life?
Definitely. So hello, everyone. My name is Naya Williams. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., second generation on my mom's side and first generation American and even Washingtonian on my dad's side. Mother's side of the family comes from South Carolina. So every now and then you'll hear a little bit of a southern twang when I speak. And my father is from Guyana. So I come from a super rich culture that loves to eat. for sure. So that was great growing up and being able to experience so many new things and try out so many different facets and different ideologies. As of right now, I'm a second year student at Harvard College. I just finished my first book. It's a poetry book called Cotton, and I'm so excited about it. And I think that I'm just in a great space because I'm able to have the semi-independence of a college student while also being able to tap into my entrepreneurial side as well. So this is just like so exciting and so incredible. And my family and I are having the time of our lives on this journey together.
Awesome. Awesome. So you mentioned your first book. So you do have aspirations to doing more writing.
Definitely. Okay. Yeah. I have started working on a couple of other manuscripts. I've always been someone who liked writing. Didn't really take it seriously until high school. When I first started writing for pleasure and enjoyment, and even therapy, it was in 2006. I lost my grandmother to colon cancer. And so writing became a way for me to reconcile the feelings and the emotions that I felt at honestly losing a second mommy in my life. So after that, I started writing and just kind of kept with it. And then high school hit. And around that time, Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, Oscar Grant, all of those people were tragically murdered, and poetry became a way for me to comment on those things without having to be on the front lines of a protest or without having to march or be right in the space, because, you know, as most parents would feel, they don't want their child to be right there in the middle of violence. So that was my way to speak out against the racial prejudice that I was seeing in the country without having to be on the front lines. After that, went to college. After my first year, I was like, you know what? I've been sitting on so many poems that I think are great, and it's time to put it out into the world and inspire other people to use their voice and their talents to make a difference. And so I pulled it together, and I think that this is just the beginning of a collection of books that I'd like to put out. I have a lot of different perspectives that I'd like to share with the world, and I think that writing is a great way for me to do that.
Awesome. Are you planning to do all poetry books, or do you have some other types of writings that you plan to put out?
You know, I think most of them are going to be poetry books, just because it comes so easily to me. Like, I can come in from a really long day and like a line of poetry will come to me, and I can stay up until midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning just writing because I'm so excited about it. But I also like flirted with the idea of writing almost like a self-help guide for millennials. I was doing this with a friend of mine from DC, and we were talking, we're like, you know, quarter life crisis is real. When you hit like college age, or when you're fresh out of college and you have that question of what am I going to do with my life, that struggle is so real.
Absolutely.
And I see so many of my peers struggle with it, and they're like, I went to school for 4 years and I still have no idea. And we were just talking about how like us exploring so many different passions and interests has helped us kind of figure out what we want to do. And we wanted to compile like just some tips and tricks for people our age, other millennials, to try and implement in their lives.
That would be dope. I think you should. And there's your podcast idea right there. Boom. She can do it. I don't even know if it's a she. I said she. Your friend in DC can do it where they're at. You can do it where you at. Y'all can upload it. Boom. There you go.
You know, that is so smart. I did not even think of that.
And that's why you're on the Jegna podcast.
For sure. For sure. I have to think about that. I'm going to have to reach out to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so so let me ask you a question, because I always wanted to ask this to someone. I've only known maybe two people that have actually either had a degree from Harvard or got one of those kind of post-degree, post-career certificates where they wouldn't study for like 2 weeks. But they're all older folks. And I never got to ask, like, what is it like to be an actual student at the, you know, the esteemed Harvard? And you're right smack dab in the middle of it. So how is it, and not just a student, but how is it being a Black person and then a Black female in a place like Harvard?
You know, there's so many feelings that I have being at Harvard and being a student at Harvard. It's still like, even a year after finding out, or over a year at this point, after finding out that I got into Harvard, it's still hard to say that I'm a Harvard student. It's still hard to even put myself and Harvard in the same sentence, because for so long, Harvard has been that school that only rich white people get into, to be very honest. It's only the school for the best, the cream of the crop, you know, the elite people that are groomed for this since day one. And that's totally not my story, not my experience. And it's not even the experience of a lot of the people who I'm friends with at school. I came from public school, started in public school, ended in public school with some private and public charter mixed in between, but I never went to like a boarding school or anything like that to prepare myself. So when I got there, I was like, what? Maybe it's a mistake. Mm-hmm. Maybe the letter was wrong. And I can tell you the story of how I found out. I applied to 7 schools, and the top contenders for me were Harvard, Cornell, and GW. And I could talk a little bit about my like relationship with GW in a second, but those were my top contenders, because I was like, you know what? I already have some ties with GW. That seems like, you know, a fair target school. It's a great school. It's FCM near family. I'm going to try my luck and shoot for Cornell. I have most of the requirements, but not all of them. So why not? And then I was like, well, you know, I really regret not applying to Harvard and Yale. So I shot my shot. And when the decisions were released for Ivies, I opened Cornell first and I saw the acceptance and I was like, what? Mm. I had accepted into Ivy League school. This is crazy. I was already stunned. I didn't need to open Yale or Harvard to be just floored. Mm-hmm. So I opened Yale and I saw that I was waitlisted. I was like, you know what? That is better than a rejection. Mm-hmm. I am so proud of myself. And I knew that they had a higher acceptance rate than Harvard. So I was like, you know what? I probably got rejected from Harvard, but even still to say that I got into one Ivy League school was just crazy to me. So I opened up my Harvard acceptance letter, and the first thing that I saw in the email was like this gif of people jumping up and down and the word congratulations.
Wow.
And when I tell you that I cried for a solid half hour, just kept rereading the letter, trying to make sure that it wasn't a cruel joke.
Right.
I could not even believe it. And even when I went to visit, when I even arrived last August as a first-year student, I was like, I'm at Harvard. Like, I'm waiting to wake up.
Right.
Because you're not told growing up, this is a place that's, you know, feasible, that right. you can go to. It's the reach. It's the one that, you know, not many people even think about, let alone go to.
Right.
So, first year there, met a lot of incredible people. And I think one of the feelings that I felt as a student at Harvard is, okay, I feel a little bit out of place because I don't come from that prep background that I right. mentioned. But after a while, I started to get to know the people, and they're so down to earth. There's so many people who are battling incredible obstacles that I hadn't even experienced in my life. And I was mm-hmm. like, wow, if they can do it, if they can push themselves, there's no reason why I shouldn't be here. And so met those people, was able to make those connections. And I think the most interesting feeling to be a Black person and a Black woman is just to have authority in the space. Mm. So being in a classroom where I'm normally the only Black person and the only Black woman, to be in a space where if I say something, it has to be validated by another peer. Or if I say something, it's kind of a question mark versus if, you know, a white male or white woman says it, it's revered, it's more so fact. And I think coming into the space a little more assertive with a lot more confidence and saying that I know my stuff, I didn't just get here because I'm Black or because I'm female. And even if they did get me there, those things don't get me the GPA that I have. So coming into the space, being in the space and knowing that I'm here, knowing that I have the right to be here, and the cognitive skills to stay in that space and to thrive, I think has been one of the bigger things that I've had to like grow and overcome in.
Wow. Do you feel like that's been more of like a mental hurdle for you to do, like for yourself? Or are there external kind of pressures, or is it both? It could be a little bit of both.
I think it's more so me than okay. the external pressures, because at home and a part of it is feeling a little out of place there. But also when you come back home, reconciling like how you've changed and how your perspective mm-hmm. has changed compared to the people you've grown up with. Mm-hmm. So being there, having to be in a space where, you know, not everyone is not necessarily competitive, but everyone knows what they want and know what they're going to do to get it. And getting to the point where I'm confident enough to say, this is what I want and this is what I'm going to do to get it, was a mental challenge for me, because like I said, when I even found out, I was like, you know, maybe it was a mistake. I really don't even believe that I was supposed to be here. So until you get to the space where you're like, you know, you're absolutely right, I'm supposed to be here, I worked hard, I have the mental capacity to be here, until you reach that place, it's always going to be hard to be in a space where you don't even feel like you belong. So that's definitely been something that I've actively worked on for myself, just reaffirming that I'm supposed to be there and I'm supposed to leave the impact that I'm attempting to and trying to leave. And also in coming home and still saying, you know, even though you've left and you may have changed in certain ways, you're still supposed to be there. You're still on the journey that you're supposed to be on. So a lot of self-affirming words, a lot of self-affirming exercises, a lot of just daily reminders to myself that you're supposed to be doing this. You're supposed to be there. Because everyone else, including the rest of the society, the rest of this world, will be the first people to tell you that you shouldn't be there, and that you weren't meant to be there.
Absolutely. So in pre-roll, we were discussing my journey a little bit, and I skipped over a portion, but hearing you reminds me. So I told you that I was on academic probation my first semester, mm-hmm. and I had a, so I was on scholarship. I had two college counselors, one for my scholarship to make sure that I stayed at the school, and then one regular person, right?
Yes.
So when I got put on academic probation, she gets flagged that, you know, I'm struggling, so I have to have a sit down with her. And we're sitting there talking, and she's a Black lady. I'm still connected with her to this day. And she sat me down, and she just kept it real with me. This is back in, like, 2005. And she's like, Brandon, you belong here. She said, you came in with about 13 people from your high school. You all know each other. And only four of you are going to graduate on time. You need to make sure you're one of those four. Mm. And what she was telling me was, this is what statistics say about Black kids from the hood. Like, you ain't gonna, like, you are going, if you want to make it here, you need to. And at that moment, what she did for me is the same thing for what you were saying, was she validated my existence for me to be there.
Yeah.
And I didn't have that going in. I was a first generation college student, public school educated. You know, like I told you, I went to school for dentistry because I was good in science and math in high school, but when I got to college, that was a whole nother level of that science and math. So those pre-dentistry classes came in my butt. And what she did, all she did was help me shift my mindset and say, you belong here and you need to make sure that you finish here and don't lose purpose. And the crazy thing is, she was right. And actually, she was right and she was wrong. Only five of the 13 of us graduated on time. And I think eight or maybe nine now actually finished their undergrad. So the statistics played out the way she said. But if she didn't have that conversation with me, it wouldn't have helped me shift for me to, push through. So you're right. You're right. And it's unfortunate that that's still happening 12 years later. Right. So, because now you're going through it.
I mean, the blessing in that entire experience is that I have a mother who is a literal queen. Mm. She is absolutely amazing. And from day one, like, she always tells me when she was pregnant with me, she would rub her belly every day and say, you are going to be a superstar. And as I grew older, she kept affirming me in my ability and my talent. So I've always had her voice in my ear saying, you have it. You don't need anything else. Everything you need is right there within you. God didn't send you into the places he's sending you into to fail, because he knows that you have what you need. And every time we always laugh because I tell her, you know, I'm sick of you being right. Everything that she has said has come to fruition, but it never, her words, and I said this to her too, her words didn't make a difference, or it couldn't make the difference in the way that it needed to until I believe it, until I feel it, until I have that voice for myself. And 1,000 people can tell you that you're brilliant, that you're smart, that you're amazing. But until you feel that way about yourself, nothing will change. So I would like to believe that your counselor kind of ignited something within you so that you're able for yourself to think, to say, you know what, I do belong here. And once you started to affirm yourself, I think that that's what made you just focus that much harder. And it's certainly what made me focus that much harder. I don't know what it was, but it was just once you hear that, you're able to make those changes within yourself. and see the results.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And, you know, when you talk about your mom and her rubbing her belly and singing and talking to you, it reminds me of this quote that says, encouragement to a child is like water to a tree. And, like, it's so important to nurture the development and the genius in our children, but at the same time, allowing them to actually bloom and blossom on their own. So yeah, absolutely. So speaking of your genius, you are an author now. You know, you're getting ready. Your book's coming out on the 28th, correct? August 28th?
Whoop, whoop. Yes.
I got it right? Yes. All right, cool. Yeah. So why now? I mean, you just finished your first year of undergrad. Are you even 21 yet? What are you doing writing books?
So I am not 21 yet. And I mean, the question that I would say to that is, why not now? Because in high school, I can go back a little bit. In high school, I was a part of a dual enrollment program. So I was able to graduate with my high school diploma and my associate's degree. And in that, I like when I went into my high school, I always came in thinking, you know, I really want to do that program. That's why I'm here. If it doesn't happen, it's fine. It's still a great public school. But if it does happen, like, that will really fulfill my goal of getting that associate degree so I can go to med school, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And when I got into the program, so many other opportunities present themselves that would make you think, why not wait until, you know, you're 22 or 23 when you have really lived a little bit more. And in those moments, like, my family, my support system, everyone around me was like, you know, why not? Tomorrow isn't promised. Next year isn't promised. And to my 21st birthday isn't promised. So if there's an opportunity for me to share my work, to share myself, to share encouragement with other people as someone who's young and someone who's just fresh out of high school, fresh after my first year of college or attending Harvard, why not do that? And I think that having that mindset has served me so well. Of course, it's been challenging. There have been a lot of moments where I was like, you know what, maybe I did bite off a little more than I can chew. Maybe, you know, I do need to take a step back. I don't have the expertise. I shouldn't do it. Three more signs telling me that's absolutely what I should be doing. So it really, for me, is about just living every day, every month, every year to the fullest, because we don't know what tomorrow holds, especially in the times that we're living in today.
So Naya, what are you studying for undergrad?
So as of right now, I'm declaring as a sociology concentrator. That's like the fancy Harvard word, concentration instead of major. Hmm. I'm planning great in sociology as a pre-med student. And so that's why I found it like really interesting when you told me that you got your degree in sociology. I was like, huh. And he didn't even know that I was planning to do that.
Nope. Not at all. That's cool though. Yeah. But you know, even though, and I made the switch, so I did the reverse of what you kind of are doing. I went from dentistry to sociology. Sociology was just kind of a natural fit for myself, because I always study people's behaviors. Like, that was one of my survival mechanisms as a child and throughout high school, is understanding people's behaviors, understanding people's behavioral patterns. Because then if I understood them, that helped me survive.
Like, yeah.
Legit. So that's pretty cool. Okay. So let's talk about Cotton. It's your debut book. Why the title Cotton?
Yes. So I titled it Cotton. It stuck with me for so long. And I've had an editor, a couple of beta readers kind of give me a nudge to change the title. But I really think that it's fitting, because when you look at cotton is a really pretty plant. It's fluffy. It looks like a cloud. It looks, in a lot of ways, it looks comforting. It looks like, you know, it's something that you would want to touch and play with and things like that. But if anyone has picked cotton or knows the history of picking cotton, it is not a fun experience. And I chose that for this collection because, as a community of Black people, of people of color, on the outside, you know, it looks like we have it all. We have the culture, we have the faith, the spirituality, we have the magic in a lot of ways. And even with that being said, our history has left us so battered, so broken, so bruised, whether that's physically, psychologically, mentally, spiritually. There are so many layers of trauma that we have to work through as people. And it is honestly painful to pick it apart. And that is really why I wanted to have a title that embodied all of that. Yes, as a community, we're beautiful. We're pretty. We have a lot of what the rest of the world wants. But at the same time, we are struggling on the inside, on the outside, in our communities and our households in a way that needs to be discussed and needs to be addressed.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great title for your book, and it really does encompass the essence of your book. I mean, it's not just art, it's not just poetry, but it talks about family dynamics, faith, healing, mental health, grief. Like, there's a lot of pieces within this book that fit that title. So it's great. Awesome. So I'm going to be honest. I did not read all the poems in the book. I hopped and skipped around and read some. So can we talk about a few of them?
Absolutely.
Awesome. All right. Tell me about Father. Tell me about Father.
Absolutely. So Father is actually a pretty new poem. It's something that I wrote in the process of compiling the manuscript, because I had, I want to say maybe 11 of these poems already pulled together in what I wanted to be the original manuscript. And I was like, you know what? This isn't long enough, and it isn't the poems that I was originally going to put out there. They didn't really represent where I started in my writing journey and where I am now. So I wrote this piece because I really wanted to touch on the spirituality aspect of what I want to offer in my art, and also kind of pick apart or tease apart some of the thoughts that my forefathers or my ancestors could have had when they were dealing with slavery, Jim Crow, Reconstruction, and all of those really challenging time periods. Or even today, parents, I think, of today's time can relate to some of what this poem speaks about, even though the language is more aligned with someone who is from the 18 or 1900s. I wrote the poem because I wanted to imagine what a mother would say, or what a parent would say, looking at their children during slavery, during, you know, the earlier parts of our history of being captured or enslaved. And I really wanted to think about what they would say. Because so often we say, oh, that couldn't have been me. If that was me, I would do this, that, and the third. And it's like, until you stepped in their shoes, until you're looking at the faces of children that you may not see again if you, you know, try and run away, or if you try and escape, they may be killed. Like, until you're in that position, you don't really even know what you would do or what you would be able to do. So that this piece is really looking at all of those nuances and kind of saying, you know, this life isn't really what I asked for, but I have faith that whoever you raise up in the end, you being a higher power for me is God as a Christian woman. But whoever that higher power is that they serve, I have faith that you're going to deliver the children of the future out of this, and you're going to raise them up and vindicate them. So it's touching on hope. It's touching on the nuances of being in this space and thinking about what they would say, looking at their children, and really touching on that spirituality, because I really do believe that our ancestors definitely prayed and definitely kept up with religion. And definitely tried to believe that there was something better on the other side of their experience, which isn't really shown in modern texts and modern media. We don't really see representations of slaves and oppressed people praying and having that type of hope. And I thought that was really important to include in this collection for that reason.
Got it. Wow. Let's see. Which was, well, I wrote a couple down. Souls of Ferguson.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that one.
So Souls of Ferguson was one of the very first poems that I wrote and was a part of this collection. I wrote it, I want to say, sophomore year of high school or junior year of high school. And it really became a family and friend favorite. I performed it at school, at home, at different venues. I still perform it. I love the poem myself. And I think that it is a really great piece for the reason that it's not just harping so much on Mike Brown. It is about Mike Brown, it is about Ferguson, but it's looking at every Black boy body that we've had to lay to rest. It's saying that all of these spaces are toxic, all of these spaces are so painful, are so volatile, and we need to do better. We need to rehab space and not try and just receive or not only receive vindication for one, you know, person who has lost their lives. So in the Soul of Ferguson, I kind of step into Mike Brown's shoes and say, you know, that could have so been me. That could have been my brother. It could have been my nephews. It could have been my uncles. It could have been any one of us. And this is a trend that I don't want to see continued. I need us to find a way out of this. I need us to find a way out of neo-slavery, because I do mention that in the poem. I'm saying that we're at a point where these slayings, these killings, you're basically telling me that my life isn't valuable and that this is what you'll do if we speak out, or this is what you'll do if we receive too much power. And I'm saying that this isn't okay. I'm in pain. I can't handle seeing another Black body on TV in a video loop showing, you know, their families crying and sobbing, and all I can think about is me, or, you know, one of my family members being in that position. So all of that is involved in this piece.
Thank you. I switched it. I had a different one, but I want to talk about this other one. Tell us a little bit about The Real Gateway Drug.
So The Real Gateway Drug is something that, again, I wrote pretty early on. I had the opportunity to speak at a conference that was hosted by the Black Women for Positive Change. And one of the things that they were talking about was violence and just Black on Black violence, violence against Black bodies, just looking at how we can be better and how we can lead better lives. And something that I felt they didn't think about was some of the internalized trauma that we deal with is the real drug, the real pain that we're dealing with. And in a lot of ways, pain can be addictive. When that's all you know and all you're used to, that is what you gravitate toward. That's why you see people in toxic relationships and can't escape them and can't get out, is because they don't know anything else. And it feeds a part of them that they didn't even know existed. So in this poem, I really wanted to kind of pick apart this this idea of pain as a drug and pain as something that we need to overcome and learn a little bit more about so that we can be better. It's not just violence. It's not just the outcome. It's the fact that hurt people hurt people. It's that ideology. So I wanted to take it a step further and think about what we can do internally to create better change on the outside.
Gotcha. Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head. One of the things that I often talk about is how pain has become so ingrained, especially in Black culture. Like, we just, it's almost normalized. Like, it's supposed to be there. And then we develop various different coping mechanisms to soothe in that pain. Whether it's various different sayings or just ways that, you know, we behave, it's like that pain's supposed to be there. Like, for example, the struggle, like embrace the struggle. Like, yes, everyone struggles on some level, but the level of struggling that we've gone through, you know, and that we continue to go through, that doesn't, it shouldn't be there, but we embrace it as it should. And I think that can be very dangerous. However, pain does offer a lot of opportunities, even for yourself. You had talked earlier about, you know, the way that you processed through your grandmother's passing was writing. And now you're using that same tool. I mean, it kind of unlocked the gift that you have to publish your own writing. So that pain that you and your family experienced has led to this new birth for you in this new art form and utilizing your creativity in a different way. So pain does have a place, but it doesn't always, it's not necessary in all times.
Definitely. And, you know, it's even, yeah, I think someone really said a powerful thing to me. They said that pain is there for a reason. Pain is not the enemy. It's what's causing, that's the enemy. So you want to feel pain. You want to be able to recognize, uh-oh, something's wrong, something changed. But you don't want to, you don't want to become so.
We had a slight technical difficulty right here, but what Naya was saying was you don't want to become used to the pain. So, you know, one thing that I noticed throughout the book as I kind of read a few of the poems and skimmed through it is that you do reference, you know, this presence of pain or going through things, which I would consider to be trauma. Was that done intentionally? Or is that just kind of, you know, your perspective on writing at the moment, where you're kind of processing through some of these more traumatic, difficult kind of experiences that folks are going through or that you were going through? Because a lot of these poems also have a personal touch to them as well. So was that intentionally done?
It was a little bit of both because, okay, like I said, my real origins with writing poetry was as a form of healing. So this writing was not only a way for me to step out against racism, injustice, and all of these different things, but at its very core, it was also healing for me. And I wanted people to, in this collection, I really want people to see that you can experience pain and you can acknowledge it and it's okay. Because that's another thing within the Black community. We do not talk about our trauma. We don't talk about our pain. And we won't make it personal whatsoever. We need to be strong. We have to be okay.
Right.
And right, it's so fine to not be okay. It's so fine to say, you know, I'm hurting. I can't handle this right now. This is too much. And even to acknowledge that seeing all of these different things happen is triggering. That's something that I'm really proud to see in, you know, my generation and even the ones a little bit ahead of us, is that we're willing to say, you know what, watching the news every day and seeing the same video loop of Eric Garner get choked and, you know, seeing that same video loop over and over again, that's triggering for me. I can't handle that. That's not beneficial to my mental wellness and my mental health. And to be able to say that, I think, is more powerful than trying to appear strong on the outside. So I want people to see in these poems that I'm being vulnerable, that I'm saying, you know, this hurts me. This is hard for me to digest, and or even, you know, it's hard and I don't want to process it. I don't want to try and find a resolution right now. I'm just angry or I'm just sad. And see that even with me saying that, I can still try and find healing. I can still try and find resolution with those feelings.
Absolutely. So toward at the end of your book, you have kind of a study guide, facilitation portion of your book, so people can utilize your poems in kind of a group method or even in a self-help type of method. And one of the questions stood out to me in that, as I read through those questions, you had mentioned if poetry is a lost art form. And I never really thought about it like that until I read that question. Like, you know, is it? And how do you feel about that? Do you feel that poetry is a lost art form?
I think, you know, that's a really hard question to answer. And that's why I included it in the book, because I thought that it would really incite some powerful perspectives on how, what we consider art to be and what art we consider to be important. And that's a huge thing, because we see in schools and academic settings that we're taking art out. Whether that art comes in the form of dance programs, visual art programs, writing programs, we do not have access in the same way that we used to, which is, in my opinion, a problem, because I found healing through art. And if someone else is in a similar situation, they aren't being exposed to other forms of healing outside of clinical healing, or other holistic healing that they may encounter in a health center or something to that effect. So I think that poetry has become a little bit of a fad, like, oh, it's really nice to hop on. It's you know, especially slamming. I think that it's become, you know, something that everyone, you know, should do. You should participate. But I think the real art of poetry is being able to express yourself when you don't need to perform it. Because I would write poetry even if I didn't perform it. I wrote poetry before I performed it. And I think getting back to that space of, you don't have to be a performer to be a poet. You don't. You don't have to open your mouth to say anything to anyone to be a phenomenal poet. And just taking that pressure off of people to be great performers in addition to being poets, I think would free so many people up to want to write poetry. I know friends and family who have journals and journals and journals of writings that they just have for themselves. And I'm like, you do realize that's poetry. That is free verse poetry. You are just writing your feelings. You're outlining them. And that is beautiful. That is art. That as an art form, that is exactly what poetry is and what it is to me. I personally think that for me as a spoken word artist or as a poet, the performing part of it is secondary. I find the real adrenaline rush, the real pleasure, when I'm able to be up at, I don't know, 12:30 at night and just write and get all of it out on a piece of paper, and to see it kind of, you know, from my head onto paper, just to see how it all pans out and what it looks like. That's where the art, that's where the beauty for it comes for me. The other part of the beauty is seeing how people react to what I write. But again, it all comes back to the writing, and not necessarily me having to say this is what it is or saying it out loud to you.
Beautiful. Any final thoughts, comments, questions that you have?
Okay, I do have a question for you.
Oh, absolutely.
If you had to write a poem that kind of sums up your experience as a Black man in today's society, what would it be titled?
Wow. Give me a second.
Yes, what take your time. What would it be titled and why?
I'm trying not to bite off anything that I've already read. I'll give you a title, but I'll give you the context of what I'm thinking first.
Sure.
So it would be something in Lights of the Invisible Man. Because I think that concept of that whole book still resonates today, but it wouldn't be the Invisible Man. It'd be like, it'd be something like seen but not felt. Right?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of hard not to see me. I'm a big black dude too. Like, like I'm like 6 foot, 245. I'm not a small dude. But at the same time, I'm often seen, but I'm not felt. Like, and when I say felt, I mean like truly understanding where I come from, understanding my perspective on things, and actually caring and being authentic about it. I think that that often doesn't happen in society. And that's not just when it comes to dealing with people from other ethnicities, but also dealing with other black men and other black women. I feel like that's one of the things that's at the core of a lot of our struggles as a people, is that on both ends, we're often seen but not felt. And because we're trying to deal with our own personal trauma so much that we don't connect very well. And when we do, it's usually in unhealthy ways, unfortunately, because we're not doing our own self-work. So, yeah. So that'd be my title. Like how I just came up with that title as I explained my context. That was great.
Yeah, that was really good. I'm impressed.
I got skills. No. Yes, I have no... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to start a podcast and you're going to write. It's going to be great.
Well, I'm in the process of writing a book. I don't know about poems, but I can write some books and I write articles and stuff. So, but yeah, you definitely should start a podcast. I think that'd be great. You know, you got a good voice too for podcasts. So I think that's something that, you know, might be your next endeavor. And you're young. You're super young. Like you're not even halfway done with college yet. So go slow, go slow. But I am extremely honored to have you on my podcast. I feel like I owe your generation for several reasons. And, you know, when I found out that you just finished your freshman year, I'm like, dang, man, that's awesome. Because honestly, like, I feel like your generation is going to set a paradigm shift, and it's up to my generation to help y'all do that. And I look to people like you, especially being a black female, very important, because I have daughters and they need leaders and role models to look at, and whatever I can do to encourage that on my end, I will. So keep doing your work, because you don't know who you may influence, and people are watching you. And being a black woman going to Harvard, and I'm not trying to put Harvard on this huge pedestal, because going to college in general is just a great thing, but that is an opportunity that a lot of people don't get, a lot of brilliant people don't get. So don't take that lightly. Don't feel ashamed, because you do belong there, and you're gonna set the world on fire. So
thank you so much. I appreciate that, especially coming from someone who's a black male, because and I've done this on Harvard's campus too. I'll perform, and in the same breath that I can love on black men, I will also call them out for not being there for black women the way that they should. So I appreciate that so much.
We can have that conversation on another platform if you want. I like to get into it with black females, because y'all got some stuff y'all need to work on too, but we ain't gonna go there today.
You're right. But we could certainly have that conversation.
So, and hey, I'm cool with y'all, you know, calling us out on our stuff, but y'all got to be cool being called out on y'all's too. And that Absolutely. Usually doesn't happen very often. So I'll just put that out there.
Okay. I'm coming with open and a receptive mind. I'm willing to listen and hear the perspective. That is very interesting.
Hey, I'm multifaceted. So, can you let folks know where they can find you, where they can purchase the book? Where they can find you online?
Sure. So I do have an author website, a homepage. You can go to nayawilliams.com, N-A-J-Y-A, williams.com. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Naya the author, N-A-J-Y-A. And you can purchase the book on Amazon. It will be available for purchase on August 28th. That is the official release day. I'm super excited about that. And if you have any questions, any comments, feel free to at me. Send me a message via the website. I'm super excited about it. And I love reading feedback. I love receiving reviews. So if you feel so inclined, I'd be absolutely happy to receive them.
Absolutely. And all those links will be in the show notes, including a link to Amazon to purchase the book. So there Absolutely. You go. So there you have it, folks. That is the lovely Naya Williams. It's very important for us to cultivate the genius of our young people, her included. I mean, it's very rare to see folks out here at 20 years old producing books, let alone producing constructive content. And I think it's very important for us to rally behind young folks like her and push it forward. And hey, I'm not even a poetry type of dude, but I did find her work very constructive. So I love to support that. And not just for young people, anybody really who's trying to help those who need help the most. I'm all about that. So she's definitely a Jegna. I'm going to keep my eye on her and put her under my fold and make sure she's doing all right and treating her good over at Harvard, because we don't want no problems, right? So anyway, be sure to share the podcast if you enjoyed it. And as always, be safe. Be constructive, be elite in whatever you do, and we will holler at you again very soon. All right? Peace.